Greetings, listeners. This is Ethan McCurdy from Top of the Noggin, which stands for the Neuroscience Outreach Group at NYU. Recently, Noggin helped put together a town hall on the neuroscience of brain injury in recognition of National Concussion Awareness Day. So, in a special panel-based podcast episode, we are providing the audio from that event, which was hosted by NYU Langone's Neuroscience Institute and the Concussion Center, here. We hope you enjoy, and please stay tuned for our next episode, this Friday, October 2nd, which will kick off our upcoming podcast series about applying to graduate school.
My name is William Barr. I'm happy to be here today and to talk or moderate this discussion on neuroscience of concussion. So what I want to do first is introduce the panel, and then the members of the panel are going to speak a little bit about themselves and their background. So to begin with, I have Samantha Larson, who's a postdoctoral fellow at the Neuroscience Institute at NYU Langone Health. Also have Daniel Torres, who's a clinical assistant professor at the Department of Neurology at NYU Langone Health, and David Javitovsky, who's a medical student at the NYU School of Medicine. So guys want to, I guess, introduce yourself or tell a little bit about yourselves?
All right, I'll go first. So I'm Daniel Torres. So I'm a clinician here at NYU. I'm one of the co-directors of the Concussion Center. And really, the vast majority of my work is clinical. And I take care of patients with all kinds of concussions from older adolescents throughout the rest of life. Starting to get involved in some clinical research as well, and also help make the different protocols that we use in terms of evaluating and treating patients here.
All right, I'll go next. I'm Samantha Larson. I am a postdoctoral fellow in Dr. Chen's lab, Dr. Richard Chen at the Neuroscience Institute. I'd also like to thank this afternoon's organizers, the NYU Neuroscience Institute and the Concussion Center, for organizing this panel and for the invitation to participate. I'm also really excited about this. I think it's a rare opportunity to have a clinician, a basic scientist, and somebody with personal experience all together to discuss some of these topics. So a little bit about my background. I did my PhD up the street at Rockefeller University, and now I've transitioned to NYU, and I'm really interested in understanding the long-term consequences of concussive brain injury, and specifically how does it predispose an individual to subsequent neuropathologies such as dementia or epilepsy. And I'm planning on, and what I'm doing in the lab is taking a multidimensional approach, really taking genomics, electrophysiological, as well as behavioral assays to tackle some of these questions. And I'm happy to just speak about any of that a little bit more throughout the course of today's discussion.
Okay, I guess I'll go next. Again, I want to start off by thanking everyone that organized this to have all three of us here, or I guess four of us, everyone that's here. Thank you for joining. So my name is David Javitovsky. I'm a fourth-year medical student right now at NYU. I'm interested in applying into physical medicine and rehabilitation, or rehab medicine, and that is largely informed by my personal experience. About 2 months into my second year of medical school, I was going out for a nice little bike ride in New York City without a helmet on, and I was hit by a car, and I sustained what's called a traumatic brain injury. So that kind of derailed my whole life. It sent me to the ICU for a month with subsequent rehab, inpatient and outpatient. And I've been kind of living this brain injury life ever since, so to speak. So the things that I'm really interested in right now is this idea that, I'm sure Dr. Torres has a lot more to say about it, but I see personally at traumatic brain injury or TBI and concussion on a spectrum of injury. And while I ended up in the intensive care unit, that people with concussions that, you know, maybe come right into the ER and then leave have very similar effects. And if you have what I've seen from these people that I've met that have had repeated concussions, they have this very, very similar sequela as I have from one very succinct injury. So this is kind of, I shared the wrong slide, I believe, but this is kind of me. So before I started sharing this, I would, can everyone see this? Can I get a thumbs up? Okay. So this is me, and maybe you know me, maybe you do not, but I would think in all likelihood that if you saw me walking on the street, this is almost exactly 3 days ago, or 3 years ago, sorry, not days, 3 years ago. And that kind of speaks to the invisibility of concussions and traumatic brain injuries. So I think that's kind of what drives me to share my story and be involved in conversations like this.
Great. Thank you. So I guess I'll say a couple words about myself. I'm William Barr. I'm a neuropsychologist. I'm the director of the neuropsychology division at NYU in neurology. And I've been involved in concussion research for a number of years now, so since actually back in the 1990s. I've had experience working with sports teams, including the New York Jets and New York Islanders. And I've been engaged in a number of, as a collaborator on a number of large-scale studies involving NCAA athletes and professional athletes. All right, so, you know, to get us started, we're going to have some questions I want to address to the group. And the first one I want to start with, just the definition of a concussion, which is something, you know, that we should start as the basics. Now, I just, you know, want to give a little background on that. Is back when I got started in this business, concussion used to be synonymous with a loss of consciousness. And it was there was misconceptions at the time about the relationship between loss of consciousness and concussion. When in terms of the sports world, what happened in the 1990s was that a number of high-profile athletes were beginning to sustain concussions or had the concussions recognized. And it was back in those days when it wasn't unusual for an individual to have what we now know as having a concussion in the middle of a game and be sent back to play in the same game. And some of these individuals had actually sustained the loss of consciousness and pulled off the field after being unconscious and returned to the game. When in the 1990s, when the work started formal research on the topic, so a committee got together with the American Academy of Neurology. And while I wasn't there, I was told that it took them 2 days of arguing for them to come down to a two-sentence definition of concussion at that time. At the same time that there's been a number of concussion definitions and return to play criteria and all the things that have been offered, at one point in the field, there was between 25 and 30 different concussion definitions and return to play guidelines that were available. So my first question to the group is, how is concussion currently defined by the medical and scientific community?
So I'll go with clinically. So, you know, I think actually when you talked about all those different definitions, you know, at this point we have sort of this common agreement in a definition, but it actually probably could be multiple things because what we've agreed to, I think, encompasses lots of different kinds of injuries. But essentially anything where there's a direct or indirect blow to the head, which causes some acceleration or deceleration, and then results in some impairment in neurological function is really the most basic definition. But like I said, the trouble with that is that, you know, there's a big difference between being very slightly dizzy and being totally unconscious is not going to be the same injury. And so we've sort of swung the other way now where it's almost, it's easy to make the definition and then harder to understand exactly what that means for a person.
Thank you, Danielle. And so that's the clinical definition. What do the neuroscientists, what do the researchers use?
I was going to say that it is actually some of what we were just discussing in terms of the difficulties in defining what this is clinically, or because it's such a broad definition, it makes it very difficult to model. And in fact, there was a paper that came out last year, a review paper that surveyed beginning from 2000 through to 2018 and looked at 400 different papers that were all working on traumatic brain injury or a concussion and tried to say, how are each of them modeling them? And there was almost no overlap between how they were modeling them. So it's very difficult, even for the scientific basic community, to create a consensus for how it should be studied. And typically what has been used as kind of the metric for animal studies is a depth of impact. And in terms of, so basically you can measure the length of unconsciousness. So our definition is similar to in humans, is how less than 30 minutes is decided to be a mild injury. Anything more than that is deformation of the brain, and it would be considered in that 15% category of a moderate to severe traumatic brain injury.
Great. Well, thank you. All right.
Pretty unbelievable. Like, you know, how many people who are out for 25 minutes have a mild injury? It's a really interesting, and you know, this is how our coding is too when we see patients. So we say less than or greater than 30 minutes, but I really care about 1 minute or 2 minutes and all the other things going along with it as well.
No doubt. All right, so what are some of the symptoms of concussion? Who wants to go with that one?
Okay, I guess I'll go with that one again. So I think we kind of break them down into realms that I think are well captured on the symptom checklist that we use in the sideline assessment tool, where you basically have head pain and neck pain type symptoms. You have balance and oculomotor related type of symptoms. And you have level of consciousness symptoms, and then also psychological symptoms can be a big part of it as well.
Okay.
I'll speak to the personal experience.
Please.
Exactly what Dr. Torres just mentioned. You know, I would kind of break that up into, for me at least, into different phases. You know, originally the head pain really clinched the symptomatology, and then later on it shifts more into those cognitive symptoms. For me at least, I think those are the long lasting effects once you've kind of managed the acute pain and levels of consciousness.
No doubt. Now, you know, one of the other things I want to emphasize is that we're talking about concussion on one end. Concussion is a part of a spectrum of severity of brain injury. And so, you know, it's important to distinguish the effects of a concussion, which are, you know, on the milder end of the spectrum, from those from moderate to severe forms of brain injury, which it sounds like from, you know, not involved in your case, David, but it sounds like you had a more severe injury than a concussion. I just want to make that clear to folks.
Yes, thank you.
All right, so then the next question comes, does a brain injury or concussion affect everybody the same? Are there differences, either initial or long-term effects on concussion in children versus adults?
So I can speak to this to some extent, but definitely a clinician should chime in. But one of the interesting things, at least in terms of modeling it with using mice of different age, is that to some extent, juvenile rodents don't have as fully of a formed circuitry as adults do. So what ends up happening is that you can end up, a lot of times, what ends up happening when you have some sort of an injury is that your cells respond, and typically at a younger age, they tend to be more, what's called more plastic, meaning that they're able to form new connections with other neurons, other cell types, and to some extent that can be beneficial. Where you are able to create new cell-to-cell contacts to preserve circuitry such that you're able to maintain function. As you get older, some of that ability actually declines. So you might be less able to make some of those connections to foster different aspects of function. And I think that that's something that, I don't know if you can speak to this, Dr. Torres, a little bit more in terms of neural plasticity in patients, in terms of young versus old, but that's definitely something that we take into consideration when we're working with different aged rodents.
So, yeah, in terms of, well, you know, plasticity is really interesting in that, you know, I feel like when I was in high school, you just were told that you had plasticity until you graduated college, and then you just started dying. And, you know, it's become pretty clear that that's not the case. And so I'm really, you know, I think it's really interesting that how older people also do have plasticity. I think, you know, there are factors that older people are more likely to have, which make it harder for them to have neuroplasticity, because I think neuroplasticity has to happen in an environment that's supporting your brain. And so I think things like sleep problems, substance use, psychiatric issues, cardiovascular health, you know, these things are all more likely to be problems in older people. And so I think if you look at it as a group, yes, you know, if you have athero in your small vessels, you know, that is the thing that's already not helping you. But I'm not sure that, you know, just age itself is clearly the thing to me. You know, then the other thing is in terms of understanding what someone is going through is a big part of treatment. And so, you know, for kids, that's a challenge with children who might not express themselves as well. And, you know, one of the things you learn in neurology is the kid that vomits every time they get in the car probably is going to have migraines later. And, you know, but they don't know that. And, you know, as a good neurologist, you say, oh, I'm going to treat cyclic vomiting with an anti-inflammatory. That's, you know, everyone's like, are you nuts? That's supposed to cause stomach problems, right? But that child can't tell you that actually that is what happens as a migraine to a child. And so, you know, I think it's a real challenge with kids along the lines of understanding necessarily what they're feeling. But, you know, overall, yes, I would agree. Children are generally more resilient, but I think we're more forgiving to children when they're having problems. You know, when an infant cries, you say, oh, are you hungry or did you poop? Or do you have to poop? But with an adult and you're crying, you know, we don't really say, oh, like, are you hungry or do you have to poop? We say, like, what's wrong with you? You have depression, right? And, you know, I think this thing of a big obstacle in concussion is a lot of abnormal internal sensations. And we don't really learn how to interpret those internal sensations through development. And, you know, I think that's another big thing that's tough as an adult is you sort of feel like you should know what your body is supposed to feel like. And someone who never had migraine and now does, it's a challenge to accept that this is going on inside of you.
Okay, great. So how about the other end of the spectrum? How about older people? What are the issues of with concussions in older people? Are older people more vulnerable to having concussions or to having recurring concussions? Or when older people get concussions, does it mean they're going to develop other neurologic conditions like possibly Alzheimer's disease?
So I would say the answer to that, there's a few answers to that. One is that often after a concussion is the first time people really look at how an older person is functioning cognitively. And so we do see a lot of situations where I've had several cases where normal pressure hydrocephalus was not obvious until the person had a concussion. And the concussion did not cause that, but it's the first time that someone said, you know, he's walking kind of funny and he's not really remembering what's going on. Or someone who is having visuospatial dysfunction, and the reason they got into the car accident was because they were already brewing a neurodegenerative disease, and it turned out that that was their fifth car accident, and it probably did give them a concussion, but they also already had something there. And then on the other end, you know, obviously there is pretty convincing evidence that a certain amount of trauma, depending on the person, can lead to chronic neuropathological changes. And whether that be solely a trauma-related dementia or accelerating an underlying dementia through abnormal protein depositions, that certainly also happens. And then just in terms of my experience, you know, sometimes I'm really amazed how well older people do. And I don't know if that's because they've dealt with a lot of stuff in their life and it's another thing that they just need to deal with. Sometimes I'm amazed people are super resilient and they had a huge subdural hematoma and needed an evacuation by a neurosurgeon. And they come in 2 weeks later feeling great. No dizziness, no headaches, mood is fine. So it's really all over the place for me.
Thank you. How about you, Sam? You said you're doing some studies on this.
Yeah, so this is actually something that, one of these things that keeps me up at night is one concussion sufficient to actually predispose you or an individual to actually develop some of these subsequent neuropathologies? And one of the things that I'm really interested in, and this is building on my background from my PhD work, is whether or not cells in your brain, so including different types of neurons as well as glial subtypes, are actually capable of retaining what we've termed an epigenetic memory of the injury itself. So for example, it's been shown in many other tissue systems, including the hematopoietic system, the lungs, skin, that long-lived cells, adult stem cells, are capable of, after some sort of an injurious exposure, of reprogramming some of their chromatin such that they can actually adapt to respond to subsequent inflammatory events in a augmented capacity. And why I think that this is really interesting to look at in the brain is there's a lot of evidence that suggests whether it be, for example, repetitive concussions where the second concussion could become worse, or the fact that there is a lot of documented cases where a single injury, a blast injury, for example, from a combat soldier could result in the veteran displaying, presenting in the clinic several years later with some sort of neurodegenerative pathology. What's happening during this latency period? And is it the fact that these cells have been primed already from the first exposure to actually then respond negatively moving forward? So that's the crux of my research. And I think that this is a very interesting and still preliminary, but it looks like there's something to it.
Great, sounds exciting. How about, are there sex differences? Do concussions manifest themselves differently in males and females? Is there any neuroscience evidence of that?
This one's a hard one to tackle. There's definitely, I think, increasing appreciation. I'm going to say increasing in like the last couple of years where people have really started to, take sex into consideration and do studies. A lot of TBI studies were originally done only in male rodents, which obviously isn't TBIs don't only happen in men, they happen in women as well. So it's really important to also study this in females, but the research is definitely lacking and the sex differences between the two in terms of severity of the injury, the impact of the injury, how long does it last? The jury is still out, but research where it has started to catch up in sex differences is definitely in neurodegeneration and subsequent pathologies. There's definitely a lot of literature out there already that suggests that there are sex differences there. And in that case, it tends to be worse for females. But I don't know if clinically you have any more knowledge on that, Dr. Torres or Dr. Barr.
Yeah, I mean, some of the clinical studies have suggested that women are more likely to report concussions and report symptoms that are related to concussions. And there have also been some studies showing that perhaps neck strength might play an impact, and that on average, women have weaker necks and therefore is their head more subjected to the forces that are applied by the injury. It's, you know, from in terms of experience, to me, I don't see a huge difference. For me, I think I've seen plenty of men and plenty of women be all sorts of things. So I think when you plot these things on a curve, you know, there's a big overlap, I think, in these curves. And so for me, there's a lot of other factors that probably impact my treatment a lot more than the gender of the person. There's also been this issue of whether hormones could play a part, which would make sense. There's a big literature looking at pituitary dysfunction after concussion. And so, you know, we know the pituitary is a little hanging on a little thread from the bottom of the brain. And if you're twisting everything around, you can tug on that connection to the brain and interfere with the transport of hormones and the signaling. But then at the same time, you look at that pituitary research and it's all over the place, where you have case series where 70% of the people, they say, have pituitary dysfunction, case series where 10% of the people have pituitary dysfunction. And, you know, it's tough because you're looking at sort of tertiary endocrine clinics that actually do these studies. And so who are they? Are they really studying, you know, a generally concussed population? It's hard to say. So, you know, I take that as, you know, whether someone is man or a woman, if things are not going the right direction, it's reasonable to think about whether they have pituitary dysfunction that could be contributing. But I will say, in my experience, having sent a lot of people to endocrine, it's extremely rare that they have a demonstrable long-term deficiencies.
All right. Fascinating area. And I'm going to just take an opportunity to make a plug for the Concussion Center Grand Rounds tomorrow, which will be on this topic, sex differences in post-concussion outcomes, by Tracy Kovesen, who's a well-regarded researcher from Michigan State University, who's going to be talking about this topic tomorrow, 5:00 virtually. You can look up the information for the WebEx. All right, so moving on to assessment. So one of the challenges with at least the milder forms of brain injury, concussion, is that there's no great objective marker, objective biomarker that's been developed. In many cases, in the more severe forms of brain injury, that there's demonstrable changes on standard structural imaging and other things, and we're lacking that in terms of diagnosing concussion. So in response to that, there's a lot of active studies going on in terms of developing biomarkers in terms of blood and CSF biomarkers that can be obtained on these things, and also imaging. So I just wanted to raise the questions: what's going on with the blood and CSF biomarkers and development of those?
I can take this one first. So as you've just mentioned, it's a really hot topic of research, and there's a lot of people doing this. And as far as using animal models, I think one of the most interesting and the most difficult things, and I think we haven't discussed this yet, and it's worth pointing out, is how complex of an injury concussion really is, and why it has been so difficult to actually identify a biomarker. So concussion is actually a two-stage injury. So the first is the mechanical stress itself. So this is caused by the actual impact, your head hitting something, or the deceleration, acceleration force that's causing damage to the brain. So there's a whole class of biomarkers that could be associated with that first stage. So this could be, for example, damage from dying neurons. It could be the actual release of different chemicals that are sensed through mechanosensation, mechanotransduction. But then what also ends up happening is that these, what they are called is damage-associated molecular patterns, get sensed by cells in the brain that then cause a larger peripheral immune response. So you have other immune cells that come into the brain. So then you have a whole entire second class of biomarkers. So where this becomes really difficult clinically, I would believe, as at least it has been in modeling this in rodents, is that depending on the time and the severity of the injury, your biomarkers change very quickly. So you'll have things that peak within the first 4 to 5 hours, then they'll start to decline, and then 24 hours later, you'll have another class that goes up. So it becomes a very dynamic response. It's really based on the severity of the injury, and is constantly moving. So it's difficult, I think, it has been difficult to pinpoint a specific biomarker that could be used clinically.
I have a question, Sam. If, you see the curves of the way that different ion handling is disturbed after these injuries, and you know the major changes are about a week, it seems like, that you have like very clearly demonstrable changes in animals. Is that, you know, I've seen those slides a lot. I don't know if that's still what we're thinking or if you could speak about it.
Definitely. So pretty much, again, this depends on like the severity of the injury and how you've decided to model it. But most of the injuries, they will tend to peak in this 3 to 7 day window immediately following injury, which is, I think, pretty counterintuitive. I think a lot of people would think that immediately following injury is when you would be at the peak of your response, when it would be the most severe. But that's actually not the case because of the fact that it is this two-step injury. That first step is basically just the brain deciding what it wants to do. Essentially, it has two options. One is to contain the injury. One is to sound the alarm and recruit help. And when it recruits help, you then create a secondary issue, which is you need to now control a massive inflammatory response. And that's where I think that this injury can actually become much more severe, is that if you have a runaway inflammatory response. So this 7-day ion, this channel, it really depends on the degree in which you have a peripheral immune response, which means that you have, for example, infiltrating neutrophils, macrophages, monocytes that come into the brain and are there to actually try to protect the neurons. And this is, I think, something else that we can potentially discuss, but there's been a lot of clinical trials that have occurred and have failed that have all aimed at targeting the inflammatory response with concussion. They've aimed at trying to block IL-6, they've aimed at trying to block TNF-alpha, and this actually has made things worse because that inflammatory response is in fact neuroprotective.
All right, great. How about the imaging? Have there been any developments in neuroimaging of a concussion? Maybe Dr. Torres?
So, I mean, with concussion, I don't have a lot that I feel like I can hang my head on right now. But I think when you look at some of the work in more severe TBI, looking at advanced MR modalities, looking at tracts, looking at different kinds of DTI imaging, I think you see some really exciting things, actually, like that really kind of thing that would apply to like David's injury, where you do an MRI, you see evidence of diffuse axonal injury, which is basically microhemorrhages in different areas of the brain. And, there have been studies looking at trying to prognosticate after these things. And, you know, when someone's really ill like that, you're saying, should we sustain them? And so people have done studies looking at sort of microscopic DTI and seeing whether those microhemorrhages actually disrupt the circuits or whether they're just sort of surrounding the circuits, and that the same thing on an MRI, the same microhemorrhage might actually create a dramatically different effect, even though it looks exactly the same on MRI, depending on whether it's the destruction of all the neurons or just a little bruise around them, basically.
So David, I'm going to bring you in on this. So, during the course of your recovery, what kind of diagnostic tests were you going through, and what do you feel was helpful in getting feedback from your medical team on how you were doing in terms of the different tests that they were giving you over time, or were any of them helpful?
Yeah. So it's honestly a little hard to say about some of them because I was heavily sedated, but I believe I had several CTs. The problem with the severe spectrum of brain injury is that with a lot of the medications and your pressure likely building up in your head, the position that you move the neck and the head can drastically affect that number of the pressure. So we had a couple scans, I believe, CTs and the like. Afterwards, in follow-up, I did far less imaging of the brain, but I still, I think we requested the medical records of it, and I read the scan, and it's all those things that Dr. Torres was just talking about. You know, the micro hemorrhages, the diffuse sexual injury, as well as some with the larger traumas, epidural hematoma, subdural hematoma, subarachnoid hematoma, all the hematomas.
Okay, great. So you know, one of the issues with the biomarkers, and particularly the imaging, the DTI with the milder injuries, is the issue of specificity. While you can do group studies showing that if you take 30 people that had a concussion, that you can show that their DTI data, their mean values, FA values, and other things are different than a control group. That you, to use that in an individual subject is where the problems is. So that you can't use it clinically yet. It's not ready for prime time. So while it's been a challenge to translate the group studies to the use with the individual because of the specificity. Now, and the reason behind that is that there's a number of overlapping conditions that can affect the DTI, things that are premorbid conditions like attention deficit disorder, comorbid conditions like depression or anxiety also lead to DTI abnormalities. So that that makes it a challenge. So in the end, a lot of diagnosis of concussion is based on a clinical examination and the evaluation of the individual's subjective symptoms. So are there concerns about the reliability of self-reported concussion symptoms in children and adults?
Well, concern, trying to think of it how you just asked it. So for me, it's not a concern in that, you know, I live in a place where I think I need to accept that I don't understand everything that's going on. And to me, the idea of saying this is due to this neuron not working versus this is due to your reaction to that neuron not working is only partially helpful. You know, I think though that person, those two people actually need very similar supports. So, you know, for me, yes, I want to establish the diagnosis clearly in terms of when the accident happened, did something happen to you? Was something abnormal. But as someone treating people, I don't feel a strong need to, you know, I want to help them develop whatever neuroplasticity response helps them the most. And that might be actually creating new vestibular pathways, and it might be learning to breathe when you don't feel right. And so I don't focus on that because both of those people are suffering. You know, whoever reports symptoms is having a problem. But yes, I mean, in terms of making the diagnosis on the sideline and people hiding symptoms, that's been pretty clearly demonstrated that if you just ask people that have an interest in not reporting the concussion, they might not. And so I see that as a bigger problem than the over-reporting side of concussions.
Okay. All right. So you bring up an issue of treatment. Are there anything new on the horizon for treatment? Sam brought up a little bit about some of the biologically based treatments. But is there anything we need to know about in the concussion treatment world that's brewing?
Yeah, I'm going to say. Not really, not yet. There's not been a new class. I think that I think as the definition has changed, and I think as the appreciation for the fact that there, it doesn't necessarily mean you need to be unconscious for X period of time. It can be much more subtle. this will change how we think, and the basic science needs a little bit of time to catch up and to figure out how to model the disease in a way that will be the most efficient to translate to the clinic. But yeah, it seems that we need to move away from targeting the inflammatory response and looking for other targets, which is what I hope to contribute.
You know, yeah, agree. You know, we really focus, what we're doing is supportive care. And we're, again, like I said before, we're trying to put their brain in an environment where it can adapt well. Because, you know, the truth is you can lose a lot of your brain and adapt to it, whether it's in a concussion or a stroke or a gunshot wound. You know, I'll never forget a veteran that I saw in residency that was missing a third of his brain. And at 95, they were asking if whether or not he had dementia, and he had no weakness, okay? That he had no motor cortex to control his right side. And he's sitting there leading his post-traumatic stress disorder groups, no weakness on what was a totally plegic side. And I said, you know, what's going on, man? Like, how did you do this? You don't have a brain. And he's like, oh, I squeezed a ball for 20 years, you know? And you know, it's, you know, even with lots of neuronal loss, you really have a major capacity to heal. And so what we're trying to do is help prevent people from poorly adapting, because just as well as the brain can adapt well, the brain can adapt very badly. One example of that is that our natural reaction to dizziness is to basically walk like we're on ice. You know, you walk kind of like a penguin where everything gets tight because you feel off balance. You shorten up your steps, but that response to feeling dizzy actually makes your head move even more, because penguins do a lot of this. And then you get even more dizzy, because the problem is that your vestibular system is a little off, and that's what's making you dizzy. So that adaptive response, because you think you might fall, actually perpetuates the symptoms. And so I see our therapy services, which are a huge, you know, they're really the healers on my team, are the musculoskeletal therapists, the vestibular therapists, the occupational therapists that help people get their eyes doing what they need to do, and the psychotherapists that help people learn better coping mechanisms. You know, they're helping people adapt in the right way, avoid the workarounds that, you know, might make you a little more functional, but in the long run, keep perpetuating symptoms. And then, you know, from my standpoint, medically, what we can do is that we know that really a lot of what's going on with headache can be cervicogenic, but especially in very chronic people, chronic symptom patients, really is similar to what's going on in migraine. And so we draw a lot on the treatment of migraine, on the medical treatment of migraine. And so in terms of medicines, that's where we focus a lot. And then also in terms of psychological symptoms, you know, it is hard to learn to cope if you're totally emotionally unstable. And so there's definitely a role in some people for giving them a medication to help them get a little more control so that they can learn the ways to support themselves. And the last thing we do medically, I would say, is, you know, sometimes fatigue is a major issue. And so sometimes we're using medicines that are a little bit stimulating. And, you know, I do actually use medicine, like I use memantine, which is for dementia, in a fair amount of patients, because that's actually has good migraine studies. So it's actually studied as like a third line migraine agent. And, you know, it generally is well tolerated. So like I that's one where it sort of has some cognitive effect, I'm sure, but also has some evidence in migraine. And so that kind of thing, you know, we'll use. The cognitive, the research that it's helping their cognition isn't there. Like the studies in PM&R, mostly coming out of rehab, aren't super, they're hit or miss. But in migraine, it has good evidence. And so, you know, that's kind of how I approach this stuff, is how are you feeling and how can we make you feel better and help you put yourself in a place to heal. We focus on exercise, physical exercise, mental exercise with meditation, and people can get better.
Great. In terms of hot topics, is there any evidence for effects of neuromodulation using a transcranial electric stimulation or photobiomodulation or anything like that? You guys aware of any of that stuff?
Not yet that I'm aware of, but I think that it's possible. I think that's an interesting thing. And I think that this, and again, please chime in from the clinical perspective, but I think that this could be really interesting in terms of depending on, again, the type of injury, and hopefully we'll get to a point where we can figure out, like, depending on the region of the brain that's affected, the deficit that's there, it's possible to even identify, like, hopefully what circuits have been involved. And I think that it is possible to do some sort of neuromodulation. But again, this is something that hasn't even really been done yet in rodents. So it's a long ways away from the clinic. As far as I know, I have not seen, for example, like some of these, like what you would use for epilepsy, like these pacemakers to try to like provide negative feedback or any sort of feedback to help rewire circuits. I have not seen that used as a therapy for concussion yet.
Okay. Another hot topic is sleep and concussion and recovery, particularly from the angle of CSF clearance and the effects of sleep. So what's the role of CSF clearance in recovery from concussion, and where's that heading?
So I mean, I think sleep. So the glymphatic system, which is, you know, something I love to talk to patients about now because it's a fancy word and they know what the lymphatic system is. So they love thinking about, you know, these bad stuff getting cleared out of your brain. You know, I think it's very early. I don't think it's much of a stretch to think that it's extremely important. I mean, I think you look at some of the studies looking at other neurodegenerative diseases and, you know, potentially how sleep might be a predictor for other neurodegenerative diseases. We know that these head traumas cause proteins to aggregate. And then we also have some studies that show mice where they make the proteins aggregate and then they look at them later and the proteins are gone, right? So we know that it is not just a put the protein there and it's there forever. It's now a fossil. Like, this is definitely a dynamic system. And I think it's super important. For me, a big question is, you know, how important is it that it be natural sleep, right? So like, sleep is super important, but is it still helpful if you give someone an Ambien to get that sleep, which we know like actually changes what the brain does in sleep? And so is that the same thing? I don't know the answer to that, but it's definitely something I think about.
Okay, great. And Sam, do you have anything to say about CSF clearance?
The only thing I can add about CSF clearance, which Dr. Torres just touched on a little bit, is the fact that there is some, that the glymphatic system does get impacted and injured by concussion and mild traumatic brain injury. And that does impair some of its ability short term to actually remove some of these aggregates. And just be specific about what these aggregates could be, at least things that people are more familiar with, like this A-beta-42, which is the pathogenic form of amyloid, does get deposited more following concussion. Tau aggregates can get deposited following injury. And these things are what you typically associate with dementia and different types of neurodegenerative disease. So it is very important for the brain to clear these. And it does take more time following injury for that to happen. And I think one of the interesting things to look at and to follow up on is that there's been some studies in mice that have shown that these things are still not even fully cleared up to a month after injury, even though behaviorally the rodent might have returned to baseline. So I think that it is one of these interesting things, and I think David has touched upon this too, is this being a silent injury, and things might outwardly appear okay. You might appear to have a return to baseline, and there might be a lot of things that are happening underneath the surface that even the individual isn't aware of that could contribute to the development of later problems.
Okay, thanks. what's the role of astrocytes in MTBI?
So astrocytes are a very specialized type of glial cell. So they have a tremendous, they're very important in the brain. So they form part of this, what's now been called a tripartite synapse. So they're a key integral member of signaling in the brain. So they also provide essential support, metabolic support to neurons. So they're really important, but they have this kind of they can have a dual role in injury, where they can either be protective and helpful, or they can actually be really neurotoxic and damaging. And for anybody who's at NYU and knows Shane Littleau, that was his big paper back in 2017, was showing that these astrocytes can actually kill neurons in specific contexts. So in injury, again, it's one of these things where it's a question of whether or not the inflammatory response runs away. So typically they're there to protect neurons and actually support them, but they do have the risk of going too far and producing things that will actually kill them. So it is this fine, it's the whole, to me, the way that I view concussion and mild traumatic brain injury is a seesaw, where there's constantly things that are being added to each side of the balance between neuroprotective and helpful and then actually causing damage. And astrocytes can tip the balance in either, or one of the many things that can tip the balance in either way.
Good. Well, thanks. All right. So we're now going to take the opportunity to open up some of the questions to the audience, and we'll go from there. So do we have questions?
I have a question here.
Yeah, please.
Hi, my name is Evan. I'm an occupational therapist at NYU's affiliate at Bellevue Hospital. Thank you for hosting this panel tonight. What's your thoughts on, you know, often we get patients who, you know, come in for a stroke or some other condition. So let's just say a stroke, and they fall in the head with not having, you know, biomarkers or imaging really necessarily to document for like a, that this person had a concussion. I mean, is it ever fair to say that a stroke patient has a concussion? Is there any way to kind of determine that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there with stroke, when you look at the MRI in stroke, MRI is actually a very good modality for stroke that doesn't, with some caveats, does not usually miss stroke and usually very well approximates what neurons are damaged. So this is what all the named syndromes for all the old neurologists that wanted to name diseases after themselves are all these different stroke syndromes. And if someone has a small lacunar stroke in the motor cortex, it should cause contralateral weakness. And if it's causing a lot more than that, I think you could consider that. I suppose one caveat is that there's a big risk of, depression and anxiety can happen regardless of stroke location and is very common after stroke, as is sleep disturbances. So there's an overlap there between those things that I think probably would make it extremely difficult to distinguish and make it a judgment call. But I think overall, you probably could get a decent idea.
Okay, any other questions?
I'm a neuropsychologist. My name is Kurt Lenfan. I'm at RHI in Indiana. So a couple of years ago, I went to the American Academy of Neurology Sports Concussion Conference, and it was so interesting to see that half the experts in the room were saying that there is no such thing as persisting post-concussion syndrome because it's all psychological. And then this other half was presenting all this research from neuroimaging and saying, you know, talking about microhemorrhages and how, you know, there's permanent brain damage and all of that. And so I work in a clinic where I see a lot of these folks with persisting symptoms and unfortunately get pulled into commenting in depositions, not as a forensic neuropsychologist, but just as a clinician, as a treating clinician. And so what do you do with that clinically? Because, I mean, my personal stance on it is that I cannot rule out permanent brain damage, right? Like, I don't think that I can do that, right? So how do you approach that?
Bill, do you want to take that one?
You know, it's a very complex area, and I agree that the field is really divided on this issue. That is there, when somebody has persistent symptoms, is this the result of an underlying brain condition, or is it the effects of psychological reaction to the injury? My personal view is that that the science does not point to the effects of a single concussion having persisting effects that would have continuing symptoms beyond a certain period. What I'm saying is that the brain injury studies that I've been talking about really don't show persisting abnormalities for more than 45 days or so. But on the other hand, there's stuff that people like Samantha are studying that might give us insight to that there's longer term effects. What we do know is a lot of the individuals that do have the persisting symptoms also have predisposing factors like psychiatric conditions and comorbid conditions that complicate the recovery. So it's a very contentious and complex area.
I mean, definitely why I wouldn't want to be a lawyer. My response to patients is that law is not medicine. You know, law is fundamentally political, and what's worth damages is not really based on biology, because we don't really totally understand biology. When I think about cause and effect, you know, when the medical examiner says a cause of death, it is not it is the thing that if you take that away, this wouldn't have happened, right? And so to me, whether you have injured neurons or whether you have a horrible psychological reaction to it, I don't think you could take away the fact that that injury, without that injury happening, they probably wouldn't be in the situation they're in. Whether the treatment be X, Y, or Z is going to be different, and whether we decide that's worthwhile, that's worth money in terms of damages, is a certain different question. And I think when you talk about legal things, yeah, we don't want everyone paying everyone for psychological distress, because then everyone would be paying everyone all the time, because the truth is tons of things cause psychological distress, and probably our legal system couldn't handle that. So I see it more of a political, not really a medical, that much of a medical question, honestly.
So there is a question in the chat that is from Dr. Peter Delabella. How long does it take for a concussively damaged neuron to recover?
So that's a really interesting question, in the sense that I think that you need to decide what does recover mean. Behave normally, behave in terms of completing its function. The neuron, as we've discussed a little bit about plasticity, that typically does happen pretty quickly. Like, neurons need to and want to make those connections, and they will do so quickly. That being said, whether or not they're forming redundant connections or connections that could ultimately make the circuit more vulnerable, that is something that is known to happen. Do the neurons actually, what I'm looking at, encode some of that information from the injury such that they become more susceptible? I think that this is an interesting thing. I think there's two parts. Recover function, if the neuron survives, it typically will, so if it survives the initial injury, it will regain function. It should maintain function. However, it could end up being more vulnerable long-term, either A, because of redundant circuitry, or B, because of epigenetics. Good question.
And I agree with Sam's point on what do you mean by recover. In the field of sports concussion, what we were all guided by early work by or recovery curves, that what we call the neurometabolic cascade, developed by Giza and Hovda at UCLA. And that really guided our early work. And that what those curves show, there's all sorts of axonal things going on and synaptic processes that they map out there. But we use that to guide our interpretation of some of the early findings we had with athletes were basically that symptoms, balance, and cognitive functioning all recovered in a relatively brief period of time in the initial samples that we studied in a matter of 7 to 10 days. Now the research has dragged that out a little bit, showing that might have been a little optimistic. But the point is that the symptoms were relatively short-lived in terms of the clinical symptoms. It mapped onto some of the early metabolic models. But it doesn't negate the point that there are processes going on with these neuronally that we're not appreciating from a clinical standpoint. And, you know, there's some evidence suggesting that might be true.
I also wonder how it interacts. You know, we know that the brain changes in response to chronic pain now also. And, you know, I wonder how that plays into what recovery means, right? That person's brain is different than it was. It's probably recovered in terms of not high risk for getting. I think if you think of it in terms of, are you high risk for getting another concussion with a mild injury? I think that short timeline makes a lot of sense. But, you know, I always say we're not the same 10 minutes from now as we were 10 minutes ago. So I don't think we should expect to be.
Speaking of recovery, there is an interesting question in the chat. Simon Chamberlain asks that he's curious about the treatment protocol following sports-related concussion and sleep. He says that one of the guidelines was not to let the patient sleep following a concussion. Why is that? He says he notes that this was 10 years ago.
I think it just has to do with the, you know, theoretically, if someone had an intracranial hemorrhage, you'd want to be able to check them. So I don't think it's the sleeping, it's knowing whether or not they're asleep or in a coma. But that is not what we say anymore.
And if you all are, there is one final question in the chat. This is Stephanie Bendick, who asks whether there is evidence of previous brain injury being exacerbated by COVID-positive patients, or alternatively, COVID causing brain injury that wasn't known to have been there before. So tying it in on a very relevant COVID note.
I think COVID's going to be a lot like concussion, where we don't know what's an infection, what's a reaction to the infection. It's fascinating. I mean, you know, we were told a couple months ago that definitely it couldn't get in neurons. They did a bunch of CSF on patients, didn't show COVID in there. And then last week there was like another article saying, oh yeah, it can infect the brain. And you have all these elderly people getting delirious from it. You know, so it seems to me that we really don't know. There's the vascular effect of COVID also, which I think we probably understand that better. In terms of the vascular effects and, you know, causing strokes, causing thrombosis in different places. That's more obviously demonstrable. But I would imagine, like many other things, it can't, you know, most things it can get into the nervous system if you, you know, in some people. So
this is something that I've actually started thinking a little bit about, just because I think obviously it's very relevant and timely. Two, as Dr. Torres just mentioned, that there was this paper that neurons do express the ACE2 receptor, and in some conditions can actually upregulate the ACE2 receptor, which means that COVID is more likely it can actually enter the cells. What it's doing, we don't really know yet. But something that I found, it was old literature that I hadn't seen, but because of COVID was brought to my attention, but it was a 2012 NEJM paper that talked about delirium and post-ICU syndrome. And actually the fact that that now we know COVID can actually induce delirium in some patients, that post-ICU syndrome delirium can actually result in cognitive impairment up to 12 months after ICU and critical care that mirrors cognitive impairment associated with TBI and dementia. So I think that this is really interesting, and we're only scratching the surface. And I think that we're going to be seeing the long-term effects of COVID for much longer than anybody would like.
And what you said about, you know, the inflammation aspect of this, right? That's like super important here. And, you know, people are doing, there are ongoing studies looking at just the effect of any kind of sepsis and the effect on the brain just from all that huge inflammatory response.
Definitely. All of us in neurology, neuropsychology are bracing ourselves that, you know, this we're in it for the long run. Okay, so I think, you know, we're going to take this point. We've gone over our time, going to conclude. So again, I want to thank the organizers, Rian Hastad, Ethan McCurdy, and Julia Dratel for putting together this great symposium. And I want to thank the speakers, the participants for their time and their expertise and knowledge. And thank all of you who joined us today.